All right, so we're in Allentown. We're going to Emmaus.
That's right. Whiskey Advocate Central.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like the living is pretty good out here. Like, there's more lawn space per plot of land.
It's nice. You know, Allentown's a small city, but you can get into the country really, really quickly. You know, I can take my hunting dog out and be in the woods and hunting in about 20 minutes from my house, or in 90 minutes I can be having brunch in New York.
So
that's you know, on a Sunday morning with no traffic.
And we're also close to the Appalachian Trail here, right?
Yeah, really close. Yeah, the
Appalachians pass right through here.
This is
just maybe
North 30, Appalachia.
30 minutes you could be there.
Which is kind of crazy, because when you think Allentown, you don't think Appalachia so much as, well, I guess you still have that Billy Joel problem.
Yeah, the Billy Joel thing was not good PR for the city. Interestingly, you know, the song was really modeled after Bethlehem, which is the neighboring city where Bethlehem Steel was in production, and name Bethlehem has some other connotations that go along with it, so I think Billy Joel just opted to plug Allentown in there for this purpose of artistic license.
Tough break.
Yeah.
But yeah. We're living here in Bethlehem. Sounds like maybe shading Jesus a little too hard.
Exactly.
All right, here we go. The Appalachia Road Trip from 2019 is now joining the public feed of the trip. Now, let me take you back. It was late spring, and even before COVID, I had always been like Snake Plissken trying to escape from New York. Because America is still the beautiful, because I'm raising children in a big city, and every once in a while, for the good of their minds and their bodies, we decided, again, this was pre-COVID, to rent a car and dive into the interior, to smell the mountain air, let them kick the tires on farm life while I drink brown liquors close to where those liquors are born. The next 4 weeks, we will be on that road trip through Appalachia, and for all the 14-hour flights and far-flung travels that this show had brought me, I really loved this journey. It took me to Asheville's master of Spanish cuisine, to a mountain cabin with an alleged moonshiner and an old friend of mine in Western Virginia, to a leader of Appalachian food culture in West Virginia. But first, we started, as I often did when escaping New York City, in Allentown, with my old friend Jeffrey Lindenmuth, the executive editor of Whiskey Advocate and one hell of a qualified drinking buddy. We sat in his offices in nearby Emmaus and did a morning blind tasting of bourbon, and were better men for it. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, this is The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world.
So, Jeffrey, tell me where we are.
We're in the Whiskey Advocate Emmaus office location in Pennsylvania.
Emmaus, Pennsylvania. Home, surprisingly, of a number of... I mean, a lot of magazine making happens in Emmaus.
Well,
it
used to, yeah.
So you are now the last magazine, the last national magazine being published in Emmaus?
The last one I know of in Emmaus.
You have kindly decided to make an exception to your regular whiskey tasting protocol, because that usually happens in the office on the west side of Manhattan with a panel of esteemed tasters.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we don't get many visitors in Emmaus, so you know, I thought we could make an exception for you. We're not going to do an official tasting, you're right. Our tasting all happens in the New York office, because we have a tasting coordinator, and we receive samples there, and we have a panel of myself and some of the other editors that taste the whiskeys blind, meaning we don't know what they are, and we don't discuss them. We record our notes, we record our scores, and that's what goes into the magazine.
So this is fucking science. Like, this is a scientific panel of experts assigning a number, and that's why it's so specific in the way that you do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the buying guide, you know, if you don't get anything else out of the magazine, the buying guide for us, as well as Wine Spectator and Cigar Aficionado, which are our sister magazines, that's really That's how we earn our keep. You know, it's the integrity of the buying guide and the integrity of the ratings that's most important to the readers.
Now, as a feature magazine writer, isn't it the feature articles? Isn't it the new travel section that you have coming up with featuring the best whiskey cities on earth?
Well, we get good feedback on that, and we put a lot of love into it. But you know, the buying guide is a lot of heavy lifting, right? Just getting the samples, rating, and scoring the whiskeys. And sometimes they're tasted multiple times. If there's something that is an anomaly or that we're uncertain about, we can market retaste. So if there's a whiskey that's, you know, known to be high quality and it doesn't do well, it's not that we want to change the score, but we want to retaste it and say, you know, let's be certain that we're making the right call here. Let's give it a fair shake and establish some consistency.
I love that. I've got an image of myself at the Trax bar underground at Penn Station, just sliding a note across the bar to the bartender and just says, retaste.
maybe revisit would be good in that context.
Revisit.
I'd like to revisit that whiskey.
Now, the real crux of that is whether that's a complimentary retaste, which I don't believe exists in the actual bar world. But you guys have the fortune in your place of just kind of drowning in whiskey.
Well, we make an effort to taste everything that's released, really. Right now, there's so many craft whiskeys coming out. That's really the deluge, is the craft distillers are just flooding us. And, you know, they're putting out a lot of young products in some cases and just throwing a lot of things at the wall. And the diversity and breadth of quality there is much greater than in traditional American distillers. So
is that a nice way of saying there's some real shit ones out there and some real great ones?
There are, yeah. There's some of both, for sure.
So how many are we talking about? How many whiskey brands do you think there are in the country now?
Oh, God. I mean, the number of craft distillers I know is probably around 1,500, but that they're not necessarily all making whiskey, so I don't know in terms of brands. I couldn't guess.
Okay, but more than one man could safely drink in a given year. Once you get to it.
Just at our Whiskey Fest events, which we hold four times a year, we typically have always over 300, break like 350 even. And that's just one night of great whiskey drinking.
How do you avoid, like, just despair? I mean, more generally, if you want to talk about that. But just in the face of so many whiskeys, all of which must be somewhat kind of bunched on the spectrum somewhere. And the idea of cataloging and categorizing assigning a numerical value to that world must just be kind of overwhelming.
Yeah, it can be. And, you know, certain categories are much more narrow on the spectrum. You know, scotch, for instance, you can have smoky, heavy scotch. You can have more delicate scotches. So there's a pretty big breadth of flavor in writing a scotch note. In the New York office, we do a lot of rye and a lot of bourbon. And all bourbon is at least 51% corn. It's all aged in new oak barrels. It's all, you know, almost all is around 4 years plus of age. So when you're trying to slice and dice bourbon, it's like some days you're just like, wow, these are so similar. Like, I how many times can I write caramel and vanilla on this page? But those are sort of the hallmarks of bourbon. And the trick is to try to pull out and discern the other nuances and the things that really make it special.
So if I'm trying to make it through to the top of your bourbon list, do I need to just chuck some cardamom in there to stand out? Or are you still you're just gonna find the best vanilla note?
The ones that rise to the top are the ones that offer complexity, right? Because if it's really simple to sort of dissect and deduce the flavors, it's like, okay, there's good quality of that. That's a good bourbon. But to rise to the top, it needs to be sublime. You know, it needs to serve up something different every time you smell it. Every time you put your nose to that glass, it's different. There's so much to discover. You put water in and it changes. And then it's this sort of intangible thing that you just go, this bourbon is somehow magic. It's balanced. It's complex. It's got more to give than what your basic $20 bourbon might.
So when you come out with your rankings and your ratings, I'm thinking of like a chart. You're charting the ranking and you're charting the price. Like, how similar is that line?
That's a good question. I mean, surprisingly, they run pretty parallel. And when we're tasting, we do not know the price. I mean, there could be a $700 bottle of bourbon in the flight, and there has been, and there could be a $30 bourbon, and we don't know the producer, we don't know the price, we don't know the proof. We really, all we know is sort of these are six bourbons or these are six ryes. That's about the extent of it. And most of our tasters could tell that without even being told, really. But we
otherwise they shouldn't be at the table.
Yeah, we're sort of briefed on what we're tasting that day, and that's about everything we know. So that $700 bourbon gets no bonus points for being $700 or being rare.
Right, and rarity is that's also a driver of cost, but not necessarily of flavor. Like, you could have a rare, an exquisitely rare, deeply shitty bourbon. Like, there's only one of this really crappy bourbon available.
Well, you know where that happens often is with really old whiskeys, especially very old bourbons. Are not really to my taste or a lot of our tasters. They tend to be too woody and taste really tired. There's some excellent bourbons still at 20 years of age, but there are bourbons being released that are over 20 years of age that I don't especially like. I can taste immediately, this has seen better days. This is over the hill.
And is that because distillers sucked back then? Or
no, it's because it's been in the barrel too long.
Okay.
And so age equals cost and age equals rarity, but there's diminishing returns where age doesn't always equal greatness.
All right. Well, we have a tasting here.
Yeah. So this is a little simulation of a blind tasting that we normally do in New York. I just had our managing editor pour a couple samples for us, and I thought we'd taste through.
Beautiful. All right. So tell me what we got.
We've got three bourbons here.
Okay.
I don't know what they are.
I'm glad that you told me they were bourbons
keep your glasses in order.
Okay.
We normally do around six in the New York office, but in a flight, we would have typically six lined up. Also, going in blind as far as procedure, when we started tasting blind in house, it took a lot of time to say, well, like, what's comfortable for a whiskey evaluator and tasting panel to taste? So we tried three and said we can do more. We tried 15 and said that's far too many. So what we kind of came to a consensus that six is a good number for us to compare. We'll always have a benchmark where we actually know that whiskey and that score.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, so that's sort of like a calibration bourbon. We don't have that here. But we would normally have a bourbon that or a comparable whiskey, tuning and calibrating your palate.
It's like your room tone for whiskey.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you drink that first.
We have that available throughout the tasting for comparison. So I can say I know this whiskey is in the same field and it scored 88 points.
Got it.
And now I can sort of compare where I need to and say, is this superior or inferior to that whiskey?
Is it always the same calibration whiskey?
No, it's different every time.
Okay.
Always different, yeah.
Got it. You don't want to live in a world where you're always doing Michter's as your North Star.
Absolutely not, no. The tasting coordinator puts a lot of thought into that, aligns the flight, aligns the calibration whiskey to it. And these are the glasses that we used. We also, as part of that, experimented with a lot of different glasses to see, you know, what served up the most concentrated and intense and accurate flavors. So these are Glencairn glasses. This is the nosing glass that our tasters most preferred. So we've kind of come up with this system that works really well for us.
So these are branded New York Whiskey Fest, which is one of your Whiskey Fest
events. Yeah, this is also the glass that everyone who goes to Whiskey Fest tastes with.
Got it. And it's a nosing glass.
It is. It's a Glencairn is the producer, and we order them by the like tens of thousands. You know, every Whiskey Fest gets its own.
Yeah.
And we actually tried rocks glasses, expensive Riedel glasses, all kinds of things as we were setting up our blind tasting regimen. And this is the one that our tasters like most.
And so by nosing, you mean you're actually supposed to be able to stick your nose in there?
Yeah. So you see by the shape, this sort of thistle shape.
Yeah.
What that does is you know, we swirl, and that gives you some surface area of the liquid on the glass, and then the aromas are concentrated in the smaller mouth. Mm.
Now, I got to ask you, I mean, not to get deeply into eugenics here, but you and I share kind of Germanish bloodlines. We've got our kind of prominent European noses that we could get pretty far into this cup. Now, my Asian brothers and sisters have different facial structure. My children also have wider, flatter noses. Are they going to have a different tasting? I mean, she's 13. She's not going to be tasting whiskey right now, but will a nosing cup, is this a Caucasian cup that we're using here?
I don't think the cup has a preference.
As I said that, I stuck my Caucasian nose so deep in this that I had to cough.
Yeah, these are
fumes came back.
I don't know the proof on them. I don't know what they are. I don't know the proof, but they're not cut with water at this point. So approach with caution. They could be anywhere from, you know, the minimum 80 proof up to the barrel strength, which could be 120 or something.
And I should say, I am no professional whiskey drinker, people. I'm losing my shit over here just from the fumes alone. The fumes is not a word. That sounds a little pejorative. You wouldn't use that.
We would say aroma, but yeah, you're definitely detecting alcohol coming off of here. Yeah. So these are, you know, room temperature, warm, neat whiskeys, and that alcohol is lifting off.
I will say, not as a tasting note, but one thing these three all have in common is they're all breakfast whiskeys because it's still 11-something in the morning.
We usually in New York schedule our tastings in the afternoon towards the end of the day, but it's not unusual when you're traveling to have to taste in the a.m.
Hmm. A lot of our friends out there are in recovery or sobered up for various reasons. I mean, I guess it's the same question bartenders have to ask themselves. Like, how do you be in this business in a world where some of us and some of the best of us have alcohol addiction problems? How does an organization like Whiskey Advocate deal with alcoholism as a... I know I'm really bringing the conversation down here, but, you know, as a thing that exists in the world, and how do you manage that?
You know, we promote responsible drinking for sure, and I think you don't last long in the industry if you're not capable of that. You know, I'm surrounded by whiskey at the office, and I have never just cracked a bottle of whiskey and had a whiskey during the day for no reason. And most days I don't drink whiskey.
So you can recognize that in yourself. You're just like, fortunately, I'm one of the people who can be around just piles and piles of cocaine and just not do a bunch of cocaine. I mean, Cocaine Advocate was one of my favorite magazines coming up in South Florida, but it's interesting. And I know I'd been listening to the guys from Joe Beef in Montreal talk about, they're both in recovery, but they have great wine programs.
Hmm.
And like figuring out how to taste wine and do it in a way which other people who are sober now are like, that's insane. They're still out there like tasting and spitting.
Tasting and spitting, huh?
Yeah. But there's nobody in this business that's like a whiskey taster and spitter because they're in recovery, but still have that really honed palate.
I mean, I spit at the office and I'll spit these.
Oh, you will?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
They're going right in my coffee cup there.
Is that why we got the coffee cups?
Well, no, we had the coffee cup because I needed a cup of coffee, but it's going to double as my spit cup today.
Boy, you're going to make the world's worst Irish coffee. this is like the frat hazing version of an Irish coffee. I got all these great bourbons, and I spit them into my coffee for you.
So do you want to tell me what you smell on these? And what we normally do, you know, I nose them. I usually nose them all first.
Okay.
I would nose them, sort of jot down my first impression, and then I would take a small sip of each. Again, just progressing through, take a small sip of each at its natural strength to sort of see how it presents. And then we have water here. I would then add water, which actually what it does is releases aromas, and it would also help you a lot by cutting down that hot ethanol burn that you're getting.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So adding water will help eliminate that, and you'll get
And I'll
you'll be less focused on the ethanol and able to focus more on the flavors.
Okay.
A lot of master distillers, when they taste, I mean, they dilute heavily. They might dilute this with equal amount of water.
No shit.
Yeah.
Because then they can really dive straight into the flavor
it's,
of it.
Exactly. It's going to really show if there's anything funky going on or anything great going on. But you know, it will show the flaws.
Whiskey as one of these kind of, you know, Ron Swanson-esque, you know, loci of man codes, you know, like, this is something where it would not be unusual to have somebody mansplain to you that whiskey should always be drunk neat, or, you know, always with a single chiseled ice cube or something. Do you at Whiskey Advocate, like, do you have a code that you endorse and enforce?
No, not at all. I drink it all sorts of ways, and many master distillers drink their whiskey with ice or drink it with water. That's not unusual at all. And you know, people that like to lecture on those finer points of consumption, I disagree with, and secondly, I think it's unfounded, because most whiskey has water added to it before it goes in the bottle. Unless it's barrel proof, you know, that whiskey didn't just happen to appear at 43% alcohol, right? That wasn't a random thing. Water has been added to that whiskey to go into the bottle. And the vast majority of whiskey is cut with water to a specific proof. So I don't think adding more water is anything that hasn't already been done.
Take that, Ron Swanson. All right. So I'm going to give you some nosing notes. Okay. 1, 2, 3, from left to right. Number one, this is going to be the worst word cloud ever. Pine?
Yeah, I get that.
Is that possible?
Just some like, pine and resin. I mean, I clearly get a lot of oak on this. This is, you know, wood forward.
Got it. So it's another kind of tree I was looking for.
Different tree. No, well, you can also get like pine needle and pine resin and forest floor kind of things happen a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, this definitely has oak, sort of a chocolatey oak type note. And you know, it's very typical bourbon. And parsing the flavors in bourbon is a little tricky, you know, because they're quite similar.
Yeah, because they're all right. You're in one kind of the forest. All right.
And do you also get sweetness? Like, there's clearly sweetness there. There's some dense, like, caramel and Cracker Jack flan.
Some flan. Pine flan. That's my...
The pine is there. There's sort of like herbal. There's an herbal quality to it.
Yeah.
Fresh like herbs. Okay. Let's take a quick nose on two.
Nose on two.
Mm. Now, this smells more mature to me. This has this very sort of like a varnish note. I often call it like wood shop. So there's like wood, and then there's this varnishy type thing. That,
right. Yeah, this.
That I equate with age. There's also, I think, a lot of flower here, like... I'm getting both like rose water and lavender and some spice too, a lot of baking spice.
Your nose has a wider vocabulary than mine does.
And I just get the impression of some density too. Do you feel like the flavor and the aromas are, they're just sort of hanging a little heavier here?
Right. And it's also, I'm thinking it's less open. It's like a little bit, you know, this one is kind of punching you a little bit, and this one is like hiding at the bottom of this nose and cup here.
You'll see what happens when we put water in. That will change.
All right, we're going to number three.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Yeah, right.
My coughing is clearly a part of my whiskey tasting style. I'm gonna do this.
Now, this I think this has some real fruit drive to it. Like, I would say I get some marmalade and a little bit more tropical, almost some like grilled pineapple quality here.
This is Caribbean bourbon. Fascinating. Yeah, that's pretty good. Uh-oh. You started to taste.
Yeah, I had to taste that one.
to see if you were, your nose was lying to you? Does it ever happen?
Yeah, that happens a lot. And actually, that's that's something that I would normally dock a whiskey for. Is, you know, I think a good whiskey should have some consistency, and it's sort of like the nose is the promise, and the flavor needs to keep it. So if it doesn't follow through on the flavor, or if it has a great nose and then the flavor's a letdown, I'm like, oh man, that's a bummer. It just breaks your heart. You got to take a few points off and say this doesn't deliver on what the nose promised. It should feel consistent from aroma to flavor to finish. It should feel like well stacked, and everything follows through.
That's, I don't know if that's happening here. Well, let's get into the tasting then. All right.
All right, so we nosed one, we'll taste it, and then I guess just for the sake of time, let's take a little sip neat, and then you could pour a little water in too.
All right, let's do it.
Mm. Oh, that's nice. It's quite oaky. Do you get a lot of oak dryness on this?
Yeah, I'm starting to back down from my pine. I feel like we are more more deciduous.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. When we taste, we don't discuss because you can be easily influenced by other people's opinions. This is not what we would normally do. We all write down our notes and keep it private, and write down our score and keep it private, and then we evaluate after. But this is, you know, just for our exercise.
And that would make a pretty shitty podcast if we just, like, all you hear is us.
We were just quiet
and being silent for 20 minutes.
That's what the tasting's like. Yeah, it would be, you know, just pens scribbling frantically for 2 hours, and then. Every now and then, you know, there'll be that just like subtle giveaway where someone's tasting and they're like, oh, and you look over and like, oh yeah, they're like having a moment with glass number 5 over there. You know, that's there's like, I know exactly what they're tasting right now. That's glass 5 because it's just magic,
blowing everybody's mind. That's a trip. Keep your sex noises down during tasting. Oh,
you know, you keep your poker face.
All right, so we got a little bit of that oak. We're gonna add some water.
Mm.
That's gonna open it up.
This is great. I like this. It's got a fair amount of oak and solid wood there. It's real dry with oak in the finish, but it's also long. It's got sweetness that just really glides along. I don't know what this is, but I like it. I think the water is giving more of that pine bough and herbal quality now on the nose.
Yeah, that's nuts. So water will react differently with different whiskeys.
I would say different whiskeys react differently to water. And generally, what we see is whiskeys that are higher proof react really well to water because it's almost like they're thirsty for the water. You know, they haven't been cut to proof for the barrel. So they're kind of craving that water, I think, sometimes. And you give it a drink and it just like opens up and shows all these other flavors. Whereas adding water to a whiskey that's only 80 proof, I think, can often hurt it. And it will sort of just fall apart.
That's interesting. Thirsty whiskey.
Mm. That's really good. Nice sort of chewy citrus oils.
Yeah, and that keeps going.
And wood on the finish, yeah.
It's not like that first kind of, you know, that first hit then kind of goes long. Now, is that something that you're also looking for always, like something that is taking you on some sort of few different notes as it goes down? Is that a universal like quality that you're searching for in whiskeys? Or sometimes it could be a great first hit and then it's gone, and that's also a good whiskey.
I think length is good. You know, long finishes are generally more rewarding than short finishes. Long finishes certainly complex. That's a hallmark, just like complexity. You know, you want complexity, you want a long finish, you want consistent follow through on flavor.
Beautiful. All right, let's go to number two.
This tastes older to me. I think. And you'll probably hear, I sort of almost like chew it a little bit. You know, it's nice to get some air in your mouth. So you take a sip and then kind of give it one of those, like get some air in there and chew it a little bit. In Kentucky, they call that the Kentucky chew.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Get your bourbon in there and give it a good chew. Smack your lips a little bit.
Man, that is mouth sounds 101 right there. You, the listener, are lucky to be in on that Kentucky chew. Usually, I'm trying not to make those sounds in the mic, but I see what you're saying, because it's like air and water are both doing different things.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's fun to play with. You know, sometimes I also, while I have the whiskey in my mouth, and I'm taking a smell at the same time, so you're getting it just like coming through your senses in all these different ways. It's up in your nasal passage, it's in the back of your mouth. I this feels older to me, both with the varnish note and also it's got real dryness and I think sort of a tobacco leaf type right. quality.
It's a little more tar or something in there.
Like. Yeah. Because it's so dry, it finishes a bit shorter than the last one. I don't think it rides
right
quite as long.
Yeah, you're totally right. It's like it's done, it's gone. It's not bad, but now you wouldn't be talking about it in the middle of a professional blind tasting, but can I just say that I like the number one better?
Sure. Like I said, I think this whiskey feels older, and we try to put that, it's not just about the score, because some people really, really like old whiskey. You know, really heavily oaked, dry, leathery, ancient whiskeys. They're not necessarily to my taste, but we try to portray that in the tasting note, because some people love that style. You know, there's going to be people that enjoy different tastes.
Now, there is a thing, you know, where they say no person can quite know how the color blue actually looks to another person. Hmm. Do you feel like that's the same way for tasting? Like, that although you can come up with similar scores or maybe have similar reactions, that there is something that's so individual in the way that somebody tastes a whiskey that you'll never quite know how that works? Or have you spent so many time saying chocolate? Yep, chocolate. That you're like, yeah, this is a universal sense.
Yeah, now we're getting into like portrait of the artist as a young man stuff or something, you know, what's the, where does perception lie? And that's true. There's obviously a plane of perception out there. We can agree on what blue is and we can agree on what chocolate is, but it doesn't mean we all perceive it the same. I do find in our tastings, I think something really interesting that comes out when you taste with a group of people through hundreds and hundreds of whiskeys is you start to find not only personal likes and dislikes, but also sensitivities. You know, some of us are like, oh, soap. I get soap on that, like huge turnoff. You know, I can't take it. And other people are like, eh, I think it's more like flowers. I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
But we definitely have our own little biases and also, you know, I think true sensitivities to what people.
I have heard that there's this monstrous group of people who can't eat cilantro.
Oh yeah, tastes like incredibly soapy.
Right, yeah. And that for me is so confounding. Like I just never see any of that soap. I think it's fucking great. So I guess it's that same thing with whiskeys. Like somebody will have a note that there's just like that's their weakness. Like they're in their palate, they just can't. It'll just overrun it. And then how do you like adjust and judge for
exactly,
that?
Exactly,
yeah. Knowing that's one woman's amazing whiskey is another woman's like bucket of soap.
Yeah, so we, you know, make, you learn about yourself and you learn about your tasting preferences and your biases and we try to look at the whiskey from a big picture viewpoint and put those aside to some degree and judge it with some kind of objective quality.
Do you have a bias that you measure for?
Mm.
You're pretty middle of the road.
I have some challenges with you know particular brands that I can recognize the whiskey instantly.
Really?
And they have estery components that don't appeal to me. So I try
estery?
Yeah, you know, a lot of
what does that mean?
Well, esters is a broad category of flavors that develop during fermentation. You know, they're highly aromatic components. And there's some whiskeys with distinctive, like, bubblegum and banana esters that and taffy that sort of, I can identify them right away. In my mind, I don't like that whiskey, but I try to be fair to it.
Knowing that there's a market for bubblegum and taffy
yeah,
whiskey
yeah.
out there. And that, absolutely, and that you shouldn't preclude them from having their
their big scores. There's people that love it.
All right, let's go to number three.
Yeah.
Here's that Kentucky Chew. Mm. Wow. That, I'm feeling the burn. That's why you went that quick to the water too, right? That's a, right? Isn't that, that feels, or am I just getting weaker through this session?
Let me see.
That feels like a stronger whiskey to me.
I don't know that it's higher in proof. I don't think so. It feels a little more light bodied, and it's more on the, this is more on the fruit side, I think, less oak driven. This has got there's some like wet walnut quality in there. I like that nuttiness.
Wet walnut. That's a great band name. What does that mean?
You know, wet walnuts. You never have wet walnuts you put on your ice cream? Oh, like those walnuts that are in caramel, sugar syrup, whatever it is.
That's a wet walnut?
Yeah.
It sounds like a hazing prank you'd do in a gym or something. Dude gave me a wet walnut. All right. Well, this might be some Pennsylvania stuff that I don't know about. Or maybe I just...
Just deprived as a child, man. What do you put on your vanilla ice cream?
I mean, you could put walnuts on there. I just never heard it. A wet walnut.
I also get like some sugar smack cereal. That sugar honey smack. So it's like a little... That little like puffy grain thing with like a nice honeyed sweetness.
God damn.
You find you refer to a lot of childhood candies and memories. That's really a fun part of it, you know. Like wood shop is a cool thing for me, or cedar chest, or you know, once in a while something really floral. I'll smell like, you know, old lady perfume, like going to church as a kid and like lots of old lady perfumes mixed in the room.
God, that's amazing. I would pay good money just to have you just break off haikus about different tasting notes and what it relates to. Because, again, I'm kind of, you know, I'm sort of stuck in whiskey here. And you're time traveling, moving across, you know, brands and experiences and olfactory memories in a way that is, that's pretty impressive. And I guess you do it so much that you're able to go directly to a deeper memory bank. And also, how can you talk about sugars, you know,
right,
without getting deep on them? Like, you can't just say, yeah, this is a little sweet, which is kind of the, you know, the bullshit that's running through my mind. You know, it smells oaky and sweet.
Yeah, and that's what it is at the surface. But then we say, okay, so what kind of oak is it? Is it like cedary, like a cedar shingle oak, or is it you know, like a freshly sawn sawdust from my eighth grade shop class oak, or is it like a dusty, earthy, you know, attic floor plank oak? You know, those are sorts of those are common things that I smell and think of.
You know who I'd want to hear doing a whiskey taste is like Bjork or something. She feels like she'd whip out some like very, yeah, just two, from the deep cabinet of her.
Two is really sensors. Interesting. You know, it's got that varnish and almost like adhesive tape kind of note. Not super phenolic, like Band-Aid, like some scotches get, but I get a little bit of adhesive or model cement, but it's in a good way. It's like it's at a threshold that it's enjoyable. It's not over the top. Like if it was just pure crazy like tube of model cement and, you know, roll of adhesive tape, it wouldn't be good. It would be a turnoff to me. But when it's there in just the right amount with, you know, sugar and oak and other things still at the front, and then you get these other little sort of sprinkles of flavor and punctuation, then it's really exciting.
Wow. It's interesting also that you can talk about something that you are enjoying ingesting and use things to describe it that are definitely not thought of as pleasurable. I mean, it's that trope. I don't even know how true this is, but somebody's always saying that, you know, all perfumes have some base of like fecal aroma. Mm. As like that's a part of your kind of, there's something about humans that's not that different than dogs. It's like, we're kind of into that scent. we don't want to talk about it. We don't even know about it. But so when you say cement glue, you're like, there's something about cement glue that's like, you know, that is appealing.
Yeah, it's like exciting to your nose. Yeah. Like, can't you think of doing a model as a kid and you're like, wow, that smells really different and intense and kind of cool. We have a Scotch taster who recently in his note wrote Burning Hospital. And it's like, you know, I read it and I'm like, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. It's like, you know, Band-Aids and medicine and then like smoke and fire. And have I ever been near a burning hospital? No, but it completely...
That's some dark shit,
completely,
man.
completely evoked the right flavors.
This is like whiskey tasting in 2019. Take some dark turns. We've all got mayhem on the mind. That's amazing. Burning Hospital. And then did you get Burning Hospital whiskey, which, by the way, would be a terrible brand for the whiskey, but did it get a good score?
I don't recall the score, but I think it did, because those are very desirable flavors for that style of whiskey, for peated scotch,
right.
You know, like phenols and Band-Aid and smoke and jalapeno, you know, those are flavors that are put there with intention.
Now, well, let's finish this tasting, because I think we're close to declaring. Can we declare a winner? Do we put numbers on this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to score them here. That's not something I would do.
I'm fucking with the man's science.
This casually.
Yeah.
But
I'm going to give it 180-20. There. That's the level of my science here.
I mean, I'll say that.
Yeah, what can you tell us legally about these whiskeys?
Well, we can reveal them and find out what they are.
Okay, let's do that. I'm going to say before we do that, and I get influenced by, you know, one being a Rite Aid, you know, white label whiskey, and the other one being, I'm sure you poured a bunch of Old Pappy for us or something. But
I don't know what they are.
I'm going to say number one is still my favorite.
Yeah, one is excellent.
Yeah.
I think one is my favorite as well. I think two is maybe a bit older. Three is also a very nice whiskey, but it has less complexity and less to offer. It's obviously well made.
I'm feeling that.
But yeah, one is giving me love.
Yeah, I'm giving it back. Good for you, one. Now, who are you? How do we find this out?
We need to call Melanie, the managing editor. Only she knows.
All right, Melanie.
Oh, it smells like whiskey fest.
It's a little mini whiskey fest. So you poured us 1, 2, 3 bourbons.
Yep.
What's number one?
Elijah Craig Barrel Proof.
Yeah, I sort of thought
Elijah Craig Barrel Proof.
So this is consistently a great whiskey, and one of the batches. It's released batch by batch. One of the batches was our whiskey of the year. 2017. It's really good.
Shout out to my buddy Sam Kim and Ricardo Gutierrez, who named their dog Elijah Craig out of intense enduring love.
Do they
love.
Have a nickname, or they actually say, come Elijah Craig?
I think it's Elijah Craig. Yeah, it's biblical.
So what's two?
The Woodford Reserve Double Oaked.
Double Oaked. Yeah. All right.
So I still think it has some age to it. I was reading all this oak as age. It actually has extra oak added.
So,
you know, I think we did say this had tobacco and a real dry oak quality to it.
Woodford Reserve Double Oak. Is that what does that even mean? Is that quadruple oak? Is that
what does it say on the bottle? I think it's in new barrels twice.
Finished.
Got it.
So
okay.
So it goes in new barrels and then it goes in more new barrels.
Beautiful. All right, what about number three?
Number three is Early Times Bottled in Bond.
Huh.
Early Times
Bottled in Bond.
What does that mean?
It means it's a minimum of 50%. Well, it's bottled at 50% alcohol. It's a minimum of 4 years old, and it comes from a single distilling season. Do you have an idea price on these? I think the Elijah Craig is about 60. So you asked sort of about how price and quality align.
Yeah.
You know. Nothing disparaging to Early Times, but I think it was obvious that didn't have the concentration
right.
and intensity of flavor of the others. So let's just see what we're looking at.
It's a new affordable release from Brown-Forman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It It tastes affordable.
I'm getting notes of affordability.
I mean, honestly, that's you know, pretty much what I
right
imagined.
And by the way, and let's hear it for affordable whiskeys. Not everybody needs to live in a world of Hibiki 21, although I do enjoy visiting that world when possible. $22.99 for Early Times Bottled in Bond.
Yeah, okay, so that's 22. And that's a perfectly good whiskey for 22. That's probably like about what I would have expected. The Woodford Double Double is also a Brown-Forman product.
Uh-huh.
So I guess we could ask, you know, does this deliver more coming from the same producers? Yes, the flavor was definitely greater. There was a lot of wood there, and this is around $50.
Oh shit. Okay.
And the number one, the Elijah Craig barrel proof, is, if you can find it, because people know that this over delivers on price, is about $60.
Oh, interesting.
So I know I didn't assign scores to these, but in my opinion, my quality ranking aligned exactly with the pricing.
Right.
How about you? You also chose the most expensive and probably universally most admired one as your favorite. So kudos.
Yeah. What is money? I've been having trouble with money anyway these days. So what is $60 versus $50 versus $23? And, you know, that idea also of drinking less, but drinking better, is always something in the back of my mind, at least as I'm justifying going up the shelf toward the top. But, you know, and of course, a lot of it has to do, and that's what makes blind testing so interesting, because, you know, marketing is such a huge part of the industry and the story that that a liquor tells about itself that gives us a story to tell about ourselves, and that kind of combination, all of that is stripped away and kind of denuded, and you're left with, you know, with what's on the palate. But I think, as the marketers would know, and certainly an amateur like myself would identify with, is like, There are a lot of feelings and emotions tied up into an alcohol choice on some level that, mm-hmm. that go beyond taste.
But I think, you know, as you said, you don't do this several times a week like I do. But I think, as somebody who enjoys food and drink and has a good palate, you were pretty much in line, you know? So they seem, what I've discovered in years of blind tasting is they actually seem to get it right more often than not. Like, we don't find a lot of $22 bottles that are absolutely stellar and get 94 points. If that happens, that is a huge anomaly. So,
and that's where you slide it over and you're like, retaste.
And we say, like, yeah, we got to be sure about
this. Yeah.
But it typically doesn't happen. I mean, these align with the price, and the guys who are making it,
they know it.
They know it, and they get it right. And we don't find a lot of $700 bottles that score 85 points. Although that's more common. It's more common to find whiskeys that under deliver. Expensive whiskeys that under deliver are unfortunately much more common than affordable whiskeys that really over deliver.
Right, but that's great, because that's where you guys can be a line of defense for the whiskey drinker.
Yeah,
or get, keep people from making some tragic mistakes up the price chart. All right, well, I'm starting on this road trip through Appalachia. We've been drinking bourbons, which is like, I'm gonna go at least very near the heartland of some of that. What am I gonna find in like West Virginian whiskeys versus Western Virginia versus Carolinian? Is there even a difference these days in terms of geography, or people can kind of make any kind wherever they stand?
Yeah, I mean, some people will tell you that Kentucky is very special because of the water and the limestone shelf there. In my opinion, you know, whiskey is cooking to a recipe. It's not like wine. I mean, barley and corn can all be shipped and sourced. You know, you put together the grains, you mash it, water can be adjusted. You're able to follow a recipe and I think make whiskey as a distillate wherever you want. How it ages is probably the bigger change. Being in warmer climates, chemical reactions are accelerated. Whiskey goes in and out of the barrel wood more rapidly and more deeply. So that's why whiskey ages so differently in Scotland versus Kentucky because of the climate. But I think above all, the reason that 95% of the country's bourbon comes from Kentucky is just culture. That's where the heritage and the knowledge to create this lies.
Right. So you can make a bourbon in New York State.
Sure.
To be a great bourbon. Or a lousy bourbon.
Yeah. I'm sure you could make lousy bourbon in Kentucky, but they'd probably run you out of the state.
Well, now, I mean, I have to say, like, the audacity of your words and your psychic connective tissue that you make between, you know, your past and your present and the whiskeys you're tasting is something that I'm lacking. But I'm feeling slightly validated, at least in my general response.
So this Elijah Craig, as you see, so this is a batch number A117, which means it was the first batch of the year released in January 2017. And the proof on this is 127. So that's maybe why you were scorching your nose hair a little bit on that on that first whiff.
That's a real whiskey there.
This takes water really well. And in fact, when Denny Potter was master distiller here, we named it Whiskey of the Year. He came to the office and he was like, "Oh yeah, I love it with an ice cube. I drink it on the rocks."
You hear like, that, all you good haters?
Good for you, man. That, yeah. If it's good enough for the guy who makes it, it's good enough for me. And yeah. I love this on the rocks.
How did you get into this? And I should say I've known you for a very long time, long before you had this job. And I've known you as a connoisseur of things, a man who just bought some kind of miter at auction because it was rare and special and now has to figure out how to get it from Allentown. These are the things that you're always up to, just like craft to the nth degree. Like, what made this job, editor-in-chief of Whiskey Advocate, a good fit for you?
You know, as you know, Nathan, yes, I really love wine. I love food. I love whiskey. But certainly Whiskey Advocate, being with M. Shankin and part of that family, is just a huge opportunity.
They're part of Wine Spectator.
Part of Wine Spectator, part of Cigar Aficionado and Wine Spectator as our siblings, you know, they own their category, right? And this was the opportunity for me to help Whiskey Advocate own the category and to bring service to people. I also have, you know, like you, a big service journalism background.
Many years putting in the good work with telling people how to live a little better.
Yeah.
On the margins, yep.
This is more fun than calculating nutritional writing for men's health, to be honest.
But how is this whiskey going to give me my best abs? That's what I really need to know.
Yeah, we need the whiskey that builds biceps, and the world will beat a path to your door.
Beautiful. Thank you, Jeffrey. Let's clink glasses for some audio here.
Let's clink our favorite.
To Elijah Craig and to Jeffrey Lindmuth, long may they prosper.
Cheers, man.
No way I'm spitting that out.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Emily Marinoff was our producer on this episode. Alexa Van Sickle was our editor. Taffy Mokanyadze, our consulting producer. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Next Thursday on this very feed, the road trip continues west and a little bit south through a tornado warning, as it turned out, to West Virginia's 180-year-old Lost Creek Farm, home to Mike Costello and Amy Dawson. I've known Mike as a writer ever since he appeared on Bourdain's West Virginia episode of Parts Unknown, and he's even better in person. We scoured the hills behind his farm for morel mushrooms and ramps. We cook. And he exploded 100 myths or so about Appalachian heritage and culture over a couple bottles of excellent Hawk Knob cider. We will meet you there.